This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Monday, we'll get the latest on the humanitarian situation in Tonga after the massive volcanic eruption. How extensive is the damage? And will Omicron be the last big variant of COVID, or are there many more to come?
Several hundred variants have been looked at. Some of them have been variants of interest. A small number have ended up being what we call these variants of concern. So the answer is we don't know.
We're starting, of course, in the Pacific today, and anxious Australians are waiting for news of family members in Tonga as phone lines to the South Pacific nation remain cut off. The 8-minute volcanic eruption, which was felt around the globe on Saturday and triggered a tsunami, caused waves that travelled as far as Alaska and South America. Royal Australian Air Force aircraft, which were delayed because of ash cloud over the region, are heading for Tonga today. While the scale of the humanitarian crisis and damage isn't yet fully known, experts warn that the initial eruption could trigger weeks of major explosions. Our reporter, Rachel Mealy.
The volcanic eruption was seen from space, but still there remains little word from Tonga. Moana Lisa Manu is, like many Australians, waiting on news of loved ones.
We're obviously scared. It was like just unbelievably shocked. It shocked all of us, basically. So because we weren't aware of it happening, or it just basically happened out of nowhere.
Her brother lives in Tonga. She told ABC Darwin her dad spent the night pacing through the house hoping for new information.
I think everyone's just anxiously waiting for some sort of news to come, that to know that their families are okay, that they've got a warm place to sleep, or, you know, just some sort of comforting news like that, because right now what's going through our heads is not, you know, comforting at all.
The Australian government says at this stage there are no reports of major casualties in Tonga, but it's waiting for a clearer picture about the damage triggered by the volcano and subsequent tsunami. Foreign Minister Maurice Payne says Royal Australian Air Force planes, which had to wait for ash to clear from the region, should provide a clearer picture about what help is needed.
And I hope that we are able to receive from the work of the Royal Australian Air Force and from New Zealand Defence Force analysis that is helpful for the government of Tonga in terms of assessing damage.
Minister Payne says there are fears the volcanic eruption severed major undersea internet cables which connect Tonga to the world.
If this is, if it is the case that there is damage to the submarine cable, then that is obviously a significant challenge for repair work. We'll work closely with all our partners to provide whatever assistance we can, including the commercial providers of the submarine cable, and also to look at what other options may be available to assist in short-term communication support. But there is no doubting the challenge that such an extraordinary volcanic eruption presents in terms of its impact, both, as you say, on communications, but also domestically in a country like Tonga.
Katie Greenwood is the Pacific head of delegation for the International Federation of Red Cross. She told Radio New Zealand her organisation is making the best guesses it can without direct communication from the Pacific Island nation.
We do know that there will be issues around health because of the air quality, and around water supplies as well. Clean water is going to be a big issue. So there's a lot we can do to prepare without knowing specific details.
Video that's emerged from Tonga since Saturday's eruption has shown damage to buildings caused by waves crashing in. Katie Greenwood says she expects temporary shelters to be needed across a wide region.
We also know that it's possible, given the inundation that has occurred, there'll be a big clean-up job. There will also be a need for perhaps some temporary shelters whilst we can shore up people's homes and any inundation that may have occurred.
Shane Cronin is a professor of volcanology at the University of Auckland.
When it erupted, the explosive energy that it produced was extremely powerful, and we think it's on equivalent magnitude, if you like, explosive magnitude, as the 1991 eruption of Pinatubo in the Philippines. which had a that one had a global impact because it was a much longer eruption. But this one, during its height, it reached a column, an eruption column of 30 kilometres high, and you know, within less than 30 minutes of the eruption cloud had spread concentrically out over a diameter of more than 350 kilometres. So extremely powerful, sort of one-in-a-decade style powerful.
He says there's potential for further eruptions in coming weeks.
Well, I would hope we've seen the worst, but, you know, the this is a pretty hyperactive volcano. It's on a very active subduction zone. So if new magma arrives in, it could be the first of a series of eruptions. My best guess would be that the future eruptions would be smaller, simply because the we've had a release of very highly gas charged magma and had a very large blast and changed the upper part of the volcano, and so further eruptions might be coming from slightly deeper, and that may suppress the energy a bit.
That's Professor Shane Cronin there from the University of Auckland, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. Well, health services looking after vulnerable community members say they still don't have access to rapid antigen COVID tests. One women's health clinic in New South Wales says the system failure is exacerbating stress for already vulnerable patients. Some Aboriginal medical services say they haven't received promised RAT tests either, despite the federal government saying it ordered 84 million tests in the first week of January. It comes as the Consumer Watchdog is investigating around 40 businesses over the pricing of RAT test kits. Carly Williams has more.
More than 2 weeks into 2022, and rapid antigen tests are still one of the hardest items to get your hands on. 84 million rapid tests have been ordered by state governments, with immunocompromised and vulnerable Australians to be prioritised. Rachel Humphreys is a social worker at Illawarra Women's Health Centre on the south coast of New South Wales. She says it's dire.
We're not able to access the rapid antigen tests. We've tried to get them from the local health district, from the Department of Communities and Justice, from our medical suppliers, from pharmacies and from our primary health network. We're not able to get RATs. We're not able to get adequate supplies of RATs or of N95 masks.
With no word on when her centre will receive RAT tests, Rachel Humphreys says it's making it very hard to support some of the most vulnerable members in the community.
One client in particular is a social housing tenant, as well as being a client of the Department of Communities and Justice, so meaning that she meets two of the eligibility that was identified as being able to have a free RAT. She had suspected COVID. She had a number of symptoms and was quite unwell. She doesn't drive. She was told to use a rapid antigen test. She's in contact with our service for support, but also another non-government organisation in addition to Department of Communities and Justice. No one could get her a RAT. We spent 3 days trying to find one. We can't get them. We've made those requests. We've contacted our providers, the ones that I mentioned before, the health district, the Department of Communities and Justice, medical suppliers, local pharmacies, and our primary health network, and we're just told that they don't exist. We can't receive them, and they don't know when we can receive them.
Key unions are calling on the federal government to provide free tests to all Australians to stop essential workers spreading COVID in the workplace. But the president of the Business Council of Australia, Tim Reid, has rejected this as it would impact supply chains that are already under pressure. He's satisfied with the existing policy of supplying concession card holders with free tests.
By making them free, you distort many components of the market. I mean, pharmacies and businesses won't stock them if they're free. And there becomes real challenges then in distribution channels and in supply chains and so on.
The consumer watchdog, the ACCC, has raised concerns that some retailers are selling COVID rapid antigen tests at inflated prices. The wholesale cost of a single rapid antigen test is between $4 and $12. The ACCC says it's received reports of tests being sold for between $20 and $30, and sometimes more than $70. Chairman Rod Sims says several businesses have been asked to explain their pricing.
Often, some of these high prices are from stores you wouldn't expect petrol retailers, tobacconists, some convenience stores. We're very much looking at those as well as pharmacies. We've had reports of outlets not issuing receipts or demanding that payment be made in cash. There's only one reason why I would think outlets are doing that, and we need to remind people that it's actually illegal not to provide a receipt if asked for purchases of $75 and above.
Federal Health Minister Greg Hunt promising Australia on RN Breakfast they're on their way to all states and territories.
So we've already provided 5.6 million rapid antigen tests to aged care. We've had the first of our deliveries to the states over the weekend. We have 70 million that are coming in over the coming weeks and months.
The Health Minister says the Commonwealth is not requisitioning tests from places like the disability sector.
We saw some of those claims last week. We have written up to those that made them. We've seen them withdrawn. That was, frankly, it was a plain lie. And that was a matter that we immediately took up where we had it, where we saw it put there. We've written to suppliers to indicate that that is not the Australian government's position, and where that was put out was a plain lie.
That's the Health Minister there, Greg Hunt, ending that report from Carly Williams. Well, after 11 days of confusion and court battles, Novak Djokovic officially departed Australia just hours before the start of the Australian Open. The world's number one tennis player flew out last night after a decision by the immigration minister to cancel his visa was upheld by the federal court. While the federal government achieved its goal of sending the Serbian tennis star packing, it's been forced to defend its handling of the messy affair, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
The immigration minister's decision was upheld by the court, but there doesn't seem to be any winners in the saga of Novak Djokovic versus the Australian government.
I can't see how anyone that was involved has walked away feeling good about what has happened.
Former doubles tennis champion and Channel 9 commentator Todd Woodbridge told ABC Melbourne the past 11 days has been a challenging time.
I'm not sure that it has done anything for tennis, the tournament, for all of those involved.
Labor's opposition spokeswoman for Home Affairs, Christina Keneally, says the federal government waited too long to act and that Novak Djokovic's 11th hour deportation is an international embarrassment.
This is the pattern with the Morrison government. Fail to make a decision, fail to act until we have a full-blown crisis on our hands. It's always too little, too late with this Prime Minister.
Djokovic departed Australia on Sunday night after the federal court upheld a decision by Immigration Minister Alex Hawke to cancel his visa for a second time. That decision was made on health, safety and good order grounds. Part of the reason for cancelling his visa was the concern Djokovic, who's unvaccinated, could stoke anti-vax sentiment in Australia. However, when asked why coalition MPs who've expressed anti-vax views and peddled conspiracy theories hadn't faced similar reprimand or repercussions, Prime Minister Scott Morrison told Nine Radio they were separate issues.
In Australia, you're an Australian, you're a citizen, you're a resident, and you're a citizen who can be here and you can express your views. If you're someone coming from overseas and there are conditions for you to enter this country, well, you have to comply with them. And it's as simple as that.
The broad remit of the Immigration Minister to use his powers under the Migration Act to cancel visas has also come under fire. Civil liberties organisation Liberty Victoria has described the decision to force Djokovic out as a troubling use of the Minister's personal powers, powers that experts say have expanded in recent years. Sangeetha Pillay is a constitutional lawyer and an expert in immigration, citizenship and refugee law.
All Minister Hawke needed to be satisfied of was that Djokovic's presence in Australia might pose a risk to community health or community order, and that's a very low threshold.
Dr. Pillay says given the minister's powers, the federal court decision was unsurprising.
the judicial review matter looked at very narrow grounds, whether the minister stepped outside of the bounds of the power given to them. And because the power given to him was so broad, that meant that it was very difficult to show that he stepped outside of those bounds.
The news of Djokovic's departure has been met with anger in his home country, where he's considered a national hero. Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić has accused the Australian government of torture.
For 10 days they were tormenting. Dare to say even torturing, because it was not only intellectual but physical.
As the top seed in the event, Novak Djokovic was hoping to secure his 10th Australian Open men's singles victory and his 21st Grand Slam title. In a statement, he says he's extremely disappointed in the federal government's decision and will take time to rest and recuperate. Lars Kiss coached Djokovic in Belgrade when he was 14 and now lives in Sydney. He says he's sure it's been a difficult time.
I honestly cannot put myself in his position right now. I think he's going to need some time to calm himself down, to forget about this whole situation. And yes, he's going to have some decisions, tough decisions to be made, how he's going to proceed.
Tennis Australia originally granted Djokovic an exemption from vaccination so he could play at the Australian Open, despite being told an exemption based on prior infection was invalid. The organisation's released a brief statement to say it respects the court's decision.
It's Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. On ABC Radio, right across Australia, you're listening to The World Today. Well, as Australia remains in the thick of the battle against Omicron, South Africa has already been through the worst of it. So what have scientists in South Africa learnt about the variant and what's coming next? Professor Helen Rees from Wits University in Johannesburg is one of South Africa's top researchers and is also an advisor to the World Health Organization.
In the beginning, we were very surprised by the number of mutations and that this seemed to have kind of developed almost sort of on its own. Many of the other variants had sort of emerged from a previous variant, and you could see the growth of the sort of family tree, if you like. Whereas this came really quite sort of as quite a novel variant with many more mutations. The other thing clinically that has been striking is that this does appear to be an infection that is more in the upper respiratory tract. You know, many people will complain of sore throat. You're probably getting it there, congestion, sore throat, and less on the lower respiratory tract. And that's good news, because it's clearly when the lungs have been infected, that's been one of the major causes of hospitalization. So we have seen lower levels of hospitalization and a much lower need and requirement for oxygen for people who are in hospital. So those are some of the things that I think we can say. But I mean, as you're experiencing, the biggest shock, I think, when it started was the rapid increase in numbers that we saw and the rapid spread, as you say, everybody that you know has, somebody's got it. Yeah.
Is the upside of it being so transmissible that it will be over and done with sooner?
I think that we can probably say that. You'll see a much higher peak than probably you've seen with the previous variant, so larger numbers. But it'll come down sooner. The problem would be for a country like Australia, where you, unlike South Africa, you've got more elderly people and probably people with more comorbidities related to age, is that you're still going to have that risk of hospitals being under real pressure just because those numbers are likely to be quite intense at the peak. South Africa didn't have as much pressure on our hospital system as we'd had with the Delta variant, because we'd have a different demographer. We have a much smaller number of older people. But I think it's something that I'm sure your health system is now looking out for.
How many more variants could we have before this is over? Or is the expectation that this will be over unrealistic in itself?
To date, you know, WHO has got expert committees that have looked at this. Several hundred variants have been looked at. Some of them have been variants of interest. Very few, a small number, have ended up being what we call these variants of concern. So the answer is we don't know. And the risk of variants occurring is much greater as long as the world doesn't have either natural immunity from infection or has been immunized. So really just a warning to say to everybody, while we're pushing to try and get through this pandemic, we're not yet out of the woods.
Could this go on for years?
I don't think so, years, if we can do what we're saying, which is particularly vaccination. There's hope that this year might see the end of this acute phase of the pandemic. I think many people think it's very likely that it'll then be endemic. That means that it'll be with us. It might well become seasonal, as we see with influenza. But there's hope that if we do what we want to do as a global community, that we can drive this pandemic into at least a more endemic and a lower risk phase of spread.
If people have been infected with Omicron this time around, is it likely to give them some protection against the next variant?
We don't know. What we're seeing is people who've had previous infections with other variants have been infected with Omicron. So they've been reinfected. We are seeing reinfection. But it's very likely that there is some level of protection if you've had one of the previous variants against future variants, because it's very likely that there's an overlap in the structure of the variant. But we really can't tell, and we can't say how any future variant of concern is going to behave.
You're talking about how important surveillance is, that is to have scientists and doctors on alert around the world for new variants. But given that South Africa was punished in a way with restrictions when it gave the news about Omicron, is there a fear that there may be some secrecy or resistance that countries don't want to speak up about potential variants?
Yes, and I think that was one thing that we said at the time, was that there should be transparency with data sharing. And South Africa did that and indeed got punished. But the other thing that we should really note was that closing of borders made absolutely no difference. Once you have a very infectious variant such as this, it is going to spread worldwide. So closing borders in that way is detrimental. It's a disincentive for the sharing of data, and it will make no difference, as was shown with Omicron, to have this knee-jerk response of closing borders.
That's Professor Helen Rees from Wits University in Johannesburg in South Africa. Finally today, the US President Joe Biden has described a siege at a synagogue in Texas as an act of terror. After 10 hours of negotiations, the FBI shot dead a British man who'd taken a rabbi and three other hostages in the town of Colleyville. He'd been demanding the release of a prisoner serving an 86-year sentence for trying to kill American service members in Afghanistan. North America correspondent Catherine Diss reports.
After almost 11 hours, FBI agents stormed the synagogue in North Texas, ending the hostage siege.
The hostage rescue team breached the synagogue. They rescued the three hostages, and the subject is deceased.
The gunman, 44-year-old British citizen Malik Faisal Akram, entered the congregation Beth Israel in Colleyville yesterday morning. Local police chief Michael Miller told reporters the morning service was being live streamed online, which allowed authorities to directly communicate with him.
The FBI called out the hostage rescue team, which is an elite hostage rescue force out of Quantico, Virginia. They immediately, when the SAC called, they got on a plane and flew out here. I think they brought 60 or 70 people from Washington, D.C. to come and help with the situation.
He was demanding the release of neuroscientist Afia Siddiqui, who's serving an 86-year prison sentence in Texas for attempting to murder U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan in 2008. He claimed to be Siddiqui's brother. Her lawyer has rejected the suggestion. While authorities believe it was a lone wolf attack, FBI agent Matthew DeSano says investigations remain ongoing.
I do not have any information right now that indicates that this is part of any kind of ongoing threat. We obviously are investigating. We'll continue to investigate the hostage taker. We'll continue to investigate his contacts. Our investigation will have global reach. We have been in contact already with multiple FBI legats to include Tel Aviv and London. We've been working closely with Secure Community Network and the Jewish Federation, and I want to continue to do that, and we will continue to do that throughout the country.
Afia Siddiqui became an icon for terrorist organisations. Former FBI agent Brad Garrett told ABC America many details of her arrest and conviction remain shrouded in mystery.
The U.S. government has stated publicly that when they arrested her, she had documents about mass destruction, about targeting sites like the Statue of Liberty. Another mystery piece is she ultimately, her second husband, was a nephew of colleague Sheikh Mohammed, one of the masterminds, obviously, of 9/11.
Little is known about the gunman, but his backing of a prisoner widely known as Lady Al-Qaeda is concerning for authorities and Jewish communities across the country who've tightened security in its wake.
That's our North America correspondent, Catherine Diss, there. That's all from the World Today team for this Monday. The PM team, they'll be along tonight. Thanks for your company. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. I'm Sally Sara. Take care.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.